I have been in Sudan before this war. I was in Sudan 2004 to 2005 with OCHA, and before that with UNHCR in different parts. Sudan is home. Sudan is a place with warm people, a culture of warmth and sharing. Now, when I was in Sudan almost 20 years ago, it was about, specific locations. The conflict in Darfur was raging, and I was OCHA's first protection officer sent to deal with legal protection issues, negotiating access in locations that we in South Darfur and in Niala, for example. At the time, you'd come to Khartoum as some sort of respite. 20 years later, I go to Port Sudan. I cannot get access to Khartoum because it is a fully war zone. The UN cannot get access right now. We're trying to get back in because of the security situation. And I stayed in Port Sudan. The last time I was in Port Sudan was 2003 when I went to snorkel on the in the Red Sea. 20 years later, it is a location where there are hundreds of IDPs, internally displaced people, in the Port Sudan, 48-degree heat. Hundreds of people in different gathering sites who have fled for their lives from different parts of Sudan, including the capital, which was a respite the last time I was in Sudan. But let me paint a picture of somebody who I spoke to, Hawa, a mother, a grandmother, a trader who was living her everyday life in the outskirts of Khartoum and in Omdurman, and the war started, and she's fled. She used to be able to get social security, her usual monthly stipend, to get her insulin injections because she's diabetic. Today, Hawa cannot. I also spoke to emergency responders, the folks who are dealing with water, sanitation, health, facilities, food in Khartoum. And I asked, what is the day in the life of somebody in Khartoum? And they said it's a living nightmare because you don't know whether you're going to be detained by either side. You don't know whether you're going to disappear, but they keep going because they are determined more than ever in the face of all of it to deliver humanitarian assistance.
According to WHO, the health situation in Sudan has reached gravely serious levels. More than two-thirds of hospitals remain out of service amid the increasing reports of attacks on health facilities. Tell us about the UN efforts to address this issue.
The UN, as I understand it from a humanitarian perspective, cannot fix an issue of a bombardment of a city, for example. What we can do, and we have done, is in collaboration with the fighting parties, in this case, what's happening in Sudan, where you have a situation where you say that these are the buildings of civilian assets in accordance to the Geneva Conventions. Unfortunately, this was not something the UN was dealing with directly in the case of Sudan per se, because there are other parties involved, as you know, the Jeddah talks and negotiations, etc. But what does it mean for the UN right now in places like Khartoum? Again, what I understand from WHO when I was on the ground, two-thirds is the minimum majority of the health facilities in Khartoum. And again, please forgive me, I keep zeroing in on Khartoum because Khartoum was the place people would go to when there was conflict in other parts of the country. Khartoum is the location where the 6 million inhabitants did not need assistance from us. And all of a sudden, Khartoum is under siege. So when you are in Wad Medani traveling for health facilities, you go to Khartoum. Or in Darfur, you go to Khartoum. From Port Sudan, you go to Khartoum, and so on. So the facilities having completely been, obliterated by the war is of significant importance. The UN, with its, partners, are delivering the basic services on the minimum that they can on a daily basis. But I come back to the ERRs, the emergency responders, Sudanese who are risking their lives also every day to ensure that, there's a lot of creativity. The Sudanese are very resilient people. Ask their money being sent home, families in the diaspora, those who have fled, trying to ensure that mothers and daughters, sons and children are getting some assistance from the health facility. But let me stop with one stark story I heard. Amina, I believe she was called, lost her aunt because she was on dialysis in a hospital in Khartoum. And when the war started, she lost her life because there was no access to this service. So it is affecting everyday lives. And I'm not saying that the internally displaced across the country do not need health facilities. That is Khartoum. Health facilities in Port Sudan right now, for example, I went to Sinkat. Now, Sinkat is not at war yet, but Sinkat will begin to see populations move from Port Sudan to Sinkat. Sinkat has minimal health services. These health services will be further impacted by the movement of people as the war continues. We will see more and more deaths based on the fact that people don't have access to basic services. And the question by most Sudanese, when I ask them, the teachers who've been displaced, the farmers who've been displaced, the health workers who've been displaced, we want peace in our country, we want the fighting to stop, we want to go back to our homes and live our normal lives.
Speaking of Jeddah talks, OCHA was part of the negotiations in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, the declaration which aimed, among other things, to facilitate the safe delivery of humanitarian assistance to those in need. However, the parties, evidently that they are not abiding by their obligations. How is the UN currently providing aid to those in need amid this war? Is there any coordination with the parties on the ground?
So I'm glad you've distinguished between the political Jeddah talks and what OCHA was doing in Jeddah, sitting at the table and just talking about what we call deconfliction. Before the 24th of May, we did not have the movement of services. It had stopped between the 15th of April and the early 20s of May. Because of our seat at the table by talking to both parties during the Jeddah talks, we were able to ensure that there were what we call deconfliction. Call party X and allow the movement of X amount of trucks. Call party Y and allow the movement of X amount of trucks. Based on that, we've been able to move within the country from Port Sudan to Darfur and other locations, 780 trucks of different types of assistance, from health assistance to food to seeds. This is an important piece for me. The farmers in Darfur and other locations need to plant. If not, you mentioned a number of people who are food insecure. People want to plant their crops. They want to grow their farms. They do not want handouts by way of food assistance. So these negotiations allowed us to work with the different parties to ensure that we moved goods within the limitations and at very, very high risk. Every day we step out, as we do in different war-torn zones, there's the ability, there's a potential of somebody losing their lives. Lots of loss of life of civilians, but also in addition to that, 18 aid workers have lost their lives since this conflict started. Now, of course, 18 aid workers, all of them Sudanese, who are minding their business trying to assist people. The second thing I'll say on the issue of Jeddah talks and conversations about parties to the conflict. As humanitarians, we apply and abide by the Geneva Conventions and the, you know, humanitarian principles of neutrality, independence, impartiality, as well as humanity. So we go to wherever we can to assist wherever we can. We also abide by civil military coordination guidelines where we are negotiating with whichever party to be able to cross into certain territories. Mm-hmm. And here we're doing the same with the cross-border, infamous cross-border movements between Chad, with thanks to the Chadian authorities, with thanks to the Sudanese authorities on either side, to say that we need to cross into Darfur from Chad, because this is where a lot of needs are as well. So within the country, negotiating with the armed groups, outside the country, negotiating cross-border.
Yeah, I have a question about Darfur, but before that, are there any attempts to revive Jeddah talks, or are there any similar initiatives?
There are quite a few initiatives that are happening from the region. Mm. I'll start zooming out into the region, the AU conversations there, IGAD conversations there. There was an aid memoir that came out of the IGAD quartet meeting. My Undersecretary General Martin Griffiths was present and was able to put firmly on the table certain conditions for us to be able to do our work as humanitarians. Mm. There's also the request by both parties, just like it happened during the Jeddah talks, to have both parties at the table where we can negotiate access at speed and at scale. Let me give you why I'm saying that. 24.7 million people, almost half the population of Sudan, are in need of humanitarian assistance or some basic services. 18.1 million people are being targeted by the UN and its partners. Of that, we've barely reached 3 million people with some form of assistance. 3 of 18, a sixth of the population that needs assistance. And I'm talking about assistance every single day, every single minute. If we do not get access at scale, where we're asking for fighting to stop, we're not political negotiators. We are humanitarian negotiators negotiating access for the people we're trying to reach. If the fighting doesn't stop, we'll not be able to, you know, raise the assistance at speed and at scale, because right now it is dire 3 months on.
Going back to Darfur, according to UNITAMS, the UN mission in Sudan, the fighting is having a severe impact on civilians. How are you navigating to
let me speak from the humanitarian perspective, because the UN has different entities. There's the political arm of the UN, the humanitarian, the development, human rights, peace, etc., security. I'm talking about the humanitarian assistance. And here, the humanitarians were able to, through the initiatives that we talked about before, Under Secretary General Griffiths was personally engaged in just trying to push the agenda of humanitarian assistance to be delivered. So talking to the parties. The 780 trucks that were moved was through the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. As you know, OCHA works on behalf of the system. There are different entities in the UN. So, of course, we try to focus on the neutral mandate that OCHA has. The UN has its complementarities. Our role with the UN agencies, funds and programs, on the humanitarian side, maintain that neutrality, because we have to talk to both parties. We have to ensure that delivery of assistance, it has not got any political connotations there, you know, related to that.
Briefly, do you have any message to the parties of the conflict?
People are dying. People are suffering. The suffering I saw in Port Sudan, a place that was where you go snorkeling in the Red Sea. Port Sudan inhabitants are civil servants who need their salaries to be able to assist the child, the mother, the displaced people from Kordofan who went to Khartoum, from Khartoum to Port Sudan. They just want peace. My message to the parties is what the message that the Sudanese people told me when I was in Sudan. Stop the war, stop the fighting, and let us go back to our homes and live our lives. The Sudanese people want peace. From the humanitarian side, we need to deliver assistance. Children are dying. Mothers are dying. Mothers are dying in transit. Children are dying in transit. I saw firsthand mothers who'd arrived across the border in Adre. I was also in Chad. And I saw a mother whose child was barely, behind her, leaning back, literally in front of your eyes, thirsty because of the arduous journey that had been made crossing one checkpoint to the next. The people of Sudan just want to get back to their daily lives. That is my message to parties.
Now let's move to the situation in Niger. In the wake of the attempted military coup there, the UN has pledged to stay in the country. Could you please elaborate on that?
The UN has a mantra, certainly, to stay and to deliver. We, the UN, at least the humanitarians, let me speak from the humanitarian perspective, in the UN as a whole, when something happens, we stay and deliver. We stayed and delivered in Sudan amidst a very difficult situation. We are staying to deliver in Niger amidst a very difficult situation. Just before coming, I spoke to my entire team in the five locations in Niger. They said four things were plaguing them right now. No electricity, because the electricity coming from neighboring countries has been stopped. Mosquitoes have gone amok because when there's no power, there's no electricity, there's a lot of mosquitoes thriving in the season right now. Fuel is going up and has gone up. Food prices have gone up and will continue to go up. So for us, we stay, we deliver amidst difficult conditions. That's what we do. We will stay with the people of Niger to deliver. That is our mandate and that's what we are there for. But again, of course, at high risk. For now, the situation, as you know, in Niger is volatile, but for now, our teams are on the ground. We also have what we call program criticality, and we review the footprint. We are talking about getting the families of UN staff members who do not absolutely have to be in the country to leave, so that in case anything goes bad, we will be able to move those who stay. But the overarching message is to stay and deliver, and I'm talking about across the country.
Any final thought?
I think as humanitarians, what we want is to continue to support people in need. In fact, my main message is there is no humanitarian solution for any humanitarian crisis. Humanitarians come in because other things have not worked out, whether it's political solutions that didn't work out, development that didn't work out, and then there's a humanitarian impact. Without those political and development solutions, the humanitarian needs continue to grow. My biggest ask right now is, if you look at the humanitarian response and appeals, they are grossly underfunded. Here, I'll take the moment to call for more funding, more support, so that we can do more as humanitarians to save lives of the people we are in those countries to serve.